Chapter 7. When I called AR to give him my answer, he told me not to worry about Diggs, but to take a cab from the station directly to his house at 355 West 84th, north side of the street, and three doors east of Riverside Drive. I was to stay with him and his wife, Carolyn, who met me at the curb and insisted on paying the taxi. She'd once been a showgirl, and it showed. Gray-blue eyes, reddish-brown hair, dimpled cheeks, small mouth, close-set teeth, and instead of the usual chorus girl button nose, a real one, which slightly flared at the nostrils. Stylishly, she hid her forehead with a scarf tied to one side. She was slim and buxom, spoke politely, and moved gracefully. As I learned later, her mother was Irish Catholic, her father Jewish. Having imbibed her mother's faith and her father's fidelity, she never divorced A.R. even though she knew he had numerous girlfriends. An attractive white stone bow-fronted house with a columned front porch, the Rothsteins' place, unlike Rodman's, was tasteful, not tawdry. The interior, however, surprised me. Expecting spacious rooms, I found instead miniature ones, almost all of them covered in priceless Oriental rugs and hung with Whistler etchings. On the ground floor was the kitchen, which I soon discovered almost always smelled of fresh-baked cookies. Four steps up on the first floor, you reached the butler's pantry, as well as the dining room and living room, the walls covered with beautiful oil paintings and watercolors. On the second floor were Carolyn's bedroom and bath, and also a drawing room where she kept her cosmetics and a large collection of women's novels. The third floor belonged to A.R. He slept, bathed, and dressed there, as well as conducted business from an adjoining study, his den, which conspicuously displayed a prized box of autographed baseballs sent to him from Babe Ruth. A.R. and Carolyn kept separate quarters because of his nocturnal habits. He returned from his Broadway haunts at 3 or 4 in the morning and awoke mid-afternoon. His bedroom windows, which looked out upon an extension of the adjoining house, were protected with iron bars. He took no chances, and covered with dark screens when he slept. The fourth floor, where I stayed, had a guest bedroom and WC, and a balcony that looked out on the street. In the bright early mornings, I often stood there watching the horse deliveries below and the taxis flying by on Riverside Drive. The first chance I had, I stopped in to see Mr. Courtney, who told me all about the safe-cracking jobs going on around town. He said that the Yeggs no longer drilled the locks. Instead, they used nitro to blow the steel plates apart, even though valuables were often lost in the blast. I also learned that trucks hauling booze were being hijacked and the stolen goods stored mostly on the Upper West Side. Mr. Courtney had been approached more than once about picking a few locks on some unmarked warehouse doors. So had Harry Houdini, whom I met at his brownstone in Harlem. I took the train to 110th and walked a few blocks east, past the Church of St. John the Divine, to West 113th, number 278, where Harry and Bess had a house stuffed full of books. On the walls were framed letters of famous people and theater bills featuring many of the great vaudevillians like Ivor Tangay, Sarah Bernhardt, and Maury Lloyd, and photographs of Tony Pastor, Eddie Cantor, and David Belasco. A sepia print of Abraham Lincoln, the man Houdini admired most in the world, hung over the fireplace. Giving Bess a bus on the cheek, Harry took my arm and we headed for Central Park just a few blocks away, where we walked for at least 2 or 3 hours while I told him all about my adventures. "Keep away from that Rothstein character. He's a gunniff." I didn't have the heart to tell Harry that A.R. was putting me up. So when Harry asked me where I could be reached, I told him that I was in the city just for the day and planned on returning to Carmel that evening. I'll be staying with my mother till fall. A.R. was reclining in a leather chair, his feet resting on a hassock and his eyes closed. Hearing me enter the room, he said from this position, "Ask me a question, any question about numbers. 67 times 8 times 4 subtract 12, for example. I'll give you the answer in a sec. 2,132. It's a game I play in my head all the time. Go ahead, test me." I'd heard Lex say that AR was a human adding machine. "All right. What's 349 divided by 17 multiplied by 71? "Easy. 1,457 with a fraction left over." "Yeah, but how do I know you're right? My own arithmetic stinks." "Here, I'll show you." He took a gold-tipped fountain pen from his shirt pocket, unscrewed the top, and scribbled the numbers on the brown paper bag holding the figs. "See, the same as I said." "How about this one?" I asked, falling in with the game and trying to stump him. 9812 times 4, 19 times 88 divided by 47. He swiveled his jaw a few times as if savoring the numbers before spitting them out. 7697618.4, AR answered. "What's 6.5% of that number?" I parried. 500345.2. "Your tops! I never saw your like before. My arithmetic teacher would envy you." AR said that in the future he'd like to take up banking. "As a kid, I used to go to the bank with my father. One day, while we were standing in line waiting for some guy in front of us to make his case for a loan, the bank president tells the guy he's a bad risk. He'll have to go next door. As soon as my father gets his loan, and why shouldn't he? Everyone called him Abe the Just. He asks, 'Is there a bank next door?' 'Cause he's never seen one. The president says it's just a little hole in the wall where a fellow with a card table, two chairs, and lots of ready dough makes loans to bad risks at sky-high rates." That's when I got the idea. AR spoke of his bankroll as if it were a person. One day troublesome and dangerous, the next happy and peaceful. He saw it dancing up the steps of a rising value or tumbling down at breakneck speed. He saw it assisting one person and obstructing another, or giving people lessons in industry and temperance. Only the clever and capable could hope to do business with such a person. There was money for the asking, but it all depended on who asked and how. One of the phones rang. AR had several. He answered it. I heard him angrily say, "That's the last time. Yeah, find out which warehouse. I got a kid who can pick locks. We'll drive off with a whole stash, ours and theirs." Hanging up the phone, he pointed to the sofa and nodded for me to join him. Carolyn, who'd been in the kitchen cooking, came to the door to announce that dinner was ready. AR apologized and said that he was needed elsewhere because of the message he'd just received, but that I could join her. She graciously smiled and retreated. AR said it was time to put me in the know. "My last shipment of scotch from Jamaica was hijacked as the boys trucked it in from Montauk Point. Lex says that by morning he'll know where it's being warehoused. I want you to spring the locks so the boys can roll up a truck and clean out the joint." "What if the place is guarded?" "These two-bit hoods think they're smart by storing the stuff in unguarded warehouses so as not to attract attention. If an earthquake shook the Upper West Side, the gurgle of giggling water would be so loud it'd drown out the horns in Harlem. I'll pay you $1,000 for each lock you crack. In a month, you'll be richer than the president and can start paying your debts." "I'm not in that business."
"You kidding?"
"Only once I opened a lock when I shouldn't have."
"You've done worse than that. You've handled hot ice, been the go-between. One telephone call and you'd be seeing the world through prison bars, or worse."
Boy, how I wished I could return to Littleton Avenue and lose myself in the attic.
"For Christ's sake, you'll be the richest kid in America."
AR loosened his tie,
something he rarely did. We had an understanding. The farm, your mom, your legal expenses. It all cost me a pretty penny. I get 90% on my investments. That's what Arnold Rothstein gets, even from the toughest guys in New York.
As his eyelids drooped and his lips parted, revealing the alabaster false uppers his dentist installed, fear seized me. I'll help you get your own liquor back, which seems only fair, and maybe I'll do a few other jobs just to pay off my debts and get a leg up, but more than that would be wrong.
Anyone who can cut the prosciutto as finely as you, Hanny, ought to go to college and study philosophy. I never saw a kid so good with the morals and logic.
I couldn't tell whether he was being sarcastic, but I knew this much. I was getting in deeper and deeper.
Come on, go and have dinner with Carolyn. When I'm out, she eats alone.
In the kitchen, A.R. took two bottles of milk from the Frigidaire and a batch of chocolate cookies from a hatch next to the stove. He smiled at Carolyn and me and said, "Milk's good for the digestion," and opened a cabinet and removed a box of bicarbonate of soda. A few grupses later, A.R. left, but not before whispering a reminder that as soon as Legs located the booze, he wanted the lock picked, not pried.
"It'll make 'em wonder," he said.
After dinner, Carolyn and I cleaned up. She had a similar effect on me as Lily. Here was someone I wanted to model myself after. Though not as beautiful or brainy as Lily, she was clearly indifferent to social standing and steadfastly supported A.R. From Legs and others, I knew that A.R. had girlfriends. But whereas Lily wanted to kill Gertie Densmore, Carolyn felt sorry for A.R.'s ladies. After all the dishes were put away and the pots scoured, I could see that Carolyn wanted to talk. She filled the coffee pot and put it on the stove. The pilot light wasn't working, so she struck a match on the burner and lit the hissing row till all the holes popped up blue.
"A scorcher today," said Carolyn.
"I was afraid it would never cool off. How Arnold can wear a suit on a day like today is beyond me. He's the best dressed man I've ever known."
"He takes such pride in his clothes. It's been that way ever since he left home. He wants his father to notice he's become a success."
"Are you hurt that his father has never accepted your marriage?"
"He told you?"
"I heard it from Legs."
"That man is evil. Don't trust him."
"Then it isn't true?"
"Oh, it's true, all right, even if the story does come from Legs."
She paused, remembering. "I was 19, Arnold 25. We were married in Saratoga, August 12, 1909, and stayed at the Grand Union Hotel. Such service. I loved the baths and the tennis courts. They even had a theater. In the evenings, Arnold and I would walk, enjoying the cool nights and fresh breezes. During the day, we'd go to the casino and racetrack." She poured two cups of coffee and lit a cigarette. I noticed the brand. Sweet Caprels.
"Like one?" she asked.
"I never touched them, but thanks anyway. Arnold hates it when I smoke, so I wait till he's out of the house." Taking a few sips of coffee and several drags on her cigarette, she continued. "No one from Arnold's family attended the wedding. Our best man was Herbert Bayard Swope, you know, from the newspapers. Margaret Powell, who married Herb a short time later, was maid of honor. When Abraham Rothstein heard we were married, he performed the Orthodox Jewish ritual for mourning. He tore his clothes, removed his shoes, and covered the mirrors. He even put on his prayer shawl and recited the Kaddish for the death of his son. Arnold's brother Edgar told him about it. Now I live here in this glass case and rarely go out, unless it's with girlfriends. Arnold's in love with the boulevard. When he isn't doing business on the corner of Broadway and 49th, or lending money in doorways, he's finagling at Lindy's, Rubens, or Jack's. That's, of course, when he's not wooing some beauty. Before I met Arnold, I acted in The Chorus Lady with Rose Stahl in the lead. We played in New York for 8 months and then toured, playing a long series of one-night stands. My most vivid memory is hurtling through the night on a train in Kansas and looking out at the little country houses with their kerosene lamps burning so cozy behind curtain windows, and thinking how I'd like to be sitting behind those curtains, talking to my husband in the soft glow of a lamp. To this day, I think of the safety and peace I felt from the flashing glimpses of those quiet homes. Arnold and I were married only a few months when I told him about the incident and asked if we couldn't move to the country. He said that all he wanted to do was make $50,000, then we could leave. But when he reached $50,000, he upped the figure to $100,000, then it was $2,000, $3,000, and finally $1,000,000. I knew, of course, that not even $1,000,000 would matter. He couldn't stop. It's not love of money that drives him, but love of playing the percentages. He takes pride in outthinking the next guy, in being a big shot. Tears clouded her eyes, which she rubbed away with her knuckles. I still love him. I can't help myself. But I'm glad you're here. Maybe we can go to the theater together.